The afternoon was again lovely after the morning rain, and the gigantic olive trees in the Vale of Tregear were sparkling in the sunshine. In this valley, too, there are evident traces of ancient occupation, and it's supposed to take its name from Apollo Tregeos, who was worshipped here. Halki is the chief town of the district, and in the house of Gabalas we took up our abode. Gabalas was a man of exceedingly jovial tendency, and on the refusal of our muleteers to accompany us further, he volunteered his services in getting together another team for us, of which he was to be the leader. He came from Crete, he said, when quite young, and was ready to go back there again as soon as the Turks had left it. Meanwhile, he managed, with his wife and son, to get along pretty well at Halki. Not that his house was by any means a paradise, for under his only bed, which was given up to us, they kept a perfect menagerie of cocks and hens and lambs, which sent up by no means a savoury odour to our nostrils, but they were afraid of leaving them out of doors, for fear of the robbers of Apeirinthos, and had nowhere better to put them. These robbers from the mountains seemed to be the bane of the villages of Naxos. Everywhere in Naxos they have a bad word for the people of Apeirinthos. A village of robbers, we were told it was, away in the mountains. It was to be our next halting place after leaving Philotti, so we were concerned at all the evil reports we had heard. For, they say, a man of Apeirinthos is clever enough to steal the sole off your boot or the hat off your head without your knowing it. And the facetious Naxiots tell an ill-natured legend about these people with great gusto, namely that Apeirinthos was a Cretan colony, that Barabbas was a Cretan, and that after his delivery from prison he returned home, where he behaved so badly that the Cretans drove him away. So he came to Naxos and founded the colony of Apeirinthos. The next morning we started for that dreaded haunt of robbers, Apeirinthos. The road led over a spur of mountains which joins Mount Jupiter with Mount Coronon and divides Naxos into two districts, the bright and sunny vales of Drimalia and Thrygea on one side and the bleak northern villages of Apeirinthos, Comiaki and Bothro on the other. As we descended on the village that Barabbas is supposed to have founded, we couldn't help thinking that, for nefarious purposes, he had chosen well, being, as it is, far off from the haunts of men, and overlooking from a rocky eminence a fairly fertile valley by which the sea could easily be approached. We had a letter of introduction to the chief legal functionary of the place, the Demarch, or, as our friend in Naxia said, the chief robber. So we thought that we should at all events be in good quarters in this den of thieves. Whilst this letter was being delivered, we stood in the little agora with our eyes firmly fixed on our luggage. The reports are true, we thought, as we looked around us, for never have I seen a wilder, more forbidding set of people than the men of Apeirinthos as they gathered round and stared at us. The town is high, faces north, and is extremely cold, so each man had on a huge brown greatcoat with the hair outside and a rim of red inside. Some had their hoods pulled over their heads, others had their cloaks hanging loosely around them and showing a powerful physique. Altogether they resembled conspirators in a chorus and made us regret having ventured amongst them. Another curious and marked type of these men was their large noses, which they screwed up when they laughed, and which increased their sinister appearance. Our misgivings were soon dissipated by the kindness of the Demarch and his brother, whose hospitality knew no bounds. Yet we could not help noticing that the windows were closely barred, and that when they went out with us they gave special instructions to the women to look after our things. "You see," said the Demarch, "there are some bad people amongst us, who live by piracy, though of late years their number has greatly reduced. But it will be long before we lose the name of being the worst people in the island. Everywhere the Naxiots have a bad name, and you have come amongst the worst of the Naxios." He laughed at this confession, and I think we felt our confidence entirely restored by his frankness. The Apeirinthos are thrifty and well-to-do. They have comfortable houses far better than the other Naxiot villagers. Many of them have made money abroad and returned to spend it in their mountain home. They have quantities of lovely red silk embroidery amongst them, Cretan work, which points to their origin. For doubtless there's much truth in the Barabbas story that Apeirinthos was colonised by Cretans at the time of one of the numerous revolutions which have driven away so many from there. And the ill will and perhaps jealousy of their neighbours, for nowhere in the Cyclades are the Cretan refugees popular, have invented the tradition about Barabbas. There is much that is quaint about this people. They speak a marked dialect with ancient forms and words which we met with nowhere else. They use the ancient form of the plural, that is to say, they will say tragouzonzi, they sing, instead of the usual tragouzoun. And the shepherds of Apeirinthos wear a wonderful garb which they call razouvrachas, which rather resembles two sacks of flannel fastened together than trousers. Their shoes are sewn together with strings of goat's hide. Round their waist they wear a cotton vest wound round and round their bodies, and skin caps on their heads. In many of their houses we saw the lyre, the formix of the ancients, still bearing its ancient name. A pretty little instrument, about half a yard long, of pear wood, such as they play as a rule at the village dances, which take place in the little square under the plantain tree. "If you will only stay over Christmas, you shall see one of our dances," said the Demarch, but even this did not tempt us to prolong our stay amongst the robbers. Inside, the houses struck us as tidier than many we had seen. Ornaments always adorned the best table, atrocious things though they were from Europe, or gourds like cottage loaves, dried scarlet and with streaks of yellow and green. And our host gave us regular Russian tea out of a brass tea urn, and other arrangements which he'd brought back with him from Russia. Nowhere in Naxos is embroidery so common as here. The beds are trimmed with it, the towels are smart enough for antimacassars. This gives an air of prosperity to the place and gratifies the eye. Apeirinthos is a large village of romantic aspect, with houses built on the edges of precipices, and above it towers Mount Phanari, another peak of the Naxios range. The houses are for the most part yellow with a peculiar lichen. The streets are tortuous and narrow, so constituted that when pirates came, the inhabitants could baffle anyone who attempted to enter their labyrinths. As for hospitality, these people are unequalled, and our host was desperately insulted at a hint of any remuneration for his kindness. As we rode away, they filled our pockets with nuts and figs, and gave us a bottle of delicious raki to warm us on our road. And we wanted it too, for about 2 hours after leaving Apeirinthos, our road ascended almost to the summit of Mount Phanari, where we were exposed to hail and a biting wind, and were lost in mist. The Naxios Mountains in winter are anything but enjoyable, wild and desolate, with just a few eagles soaring in the air now and again. Rare birds in the islands, though common enough on the mainland. Be careful when you see one to pass him on your right. It is considered unlucky in Greece to see an eagle on your left. Presently we came to a particularly gusty spot. Gabalas informed us that this spot was called, as it justly deserved, the dancing place of the winds. And this is how they dance, he said, as he went through some of the wild evolutions of the Syrtos for our benefit, which has in it so much of the ancient Pyrrhic dance. And very funny he looked as he impersonated the antics of the winds in the mist on the mountain top. The Greeks have still the same vivid imaginations as of old, and love to personify the mysterious. We left the village of Bothro below us, close to which the emery mines of Naxos lie, and we reached Komiaki late in the afternoon. This is the highest village in the island, and for the 2 days that we remained there we were perpetually in a mist. The village is only approached by roads which cross over the summit of the mountain. Sometimes for a fortnight at a time no one can get to or from the village in the winter, owing to falls of snow. I must say I felt very uneasy all the time we were there, lest this ill luck should befall us. A fortnight amongst the robbers would be preferable. The only decent house in the village of Komiaki belongs to the D-mark, Konstantinides, whom we had met in Naxia and who had bid us to stay at his house if we visited his village. He was away when we arrived, but his pretty daughter, Athena, received us with the best possible grace, whilst we, with what seemed to us unparalleled effrontery, turned her father's house inside out. It's quite the fashion in Greece for travellers to act like young Marlowe in She Stoops to Conquer, only in this case you deliberately turn your host's house into an inn without the excuse of having mistaken it for one. We ordered our own meals. We sent for more ashes in the brazier whenever it got low. Our muleteers sat in a row in the parlour. And Gabalas, to our horror, treated Miss Athena in what we thought a horribly familiar manner. But there is no distinction of class in these parts. The dirtiest yokel who comes in is asked to sit down and given a glass of raki by the head lady of the place. Gabalas took off his boots and stockings in the drawing room to dry them at the brazier. Otherwise, he said, he should catch a cold in his feet. And then in walked a miserable, fever-stricken peasant to beg for quinine, shivering and wet with the mist. He could not resist the sight of a warm brazier, so he drew up a chair and joined our circle, to the surprise of no one. Komiaki is but a miserable village of mountain shepherds. The houses are perfect hovels, where the families live with their pigs, their cocks and hens, and their store of wood, whilst the baby's only cradle is the pig trough. We went into many of them and found their inhabitants truly primitive folk. Nowhere is the belief in Kalkageri more prevalent than there. Evil spirits which appear on earth for 10 days only in the year, from Christmas to Epiphany. An old hag we visited gave us a curious account of them. During these 10 days, these spirits dwell in caves, subsisting, like the Amazons of old, on snakes and lizards, and sometimes women for a treat, if they can entrap them. At night they dance till cockcrow and enter houses by the chimneys. So a careful housewife is bound during this time to keep embers smouldering all night on her hearth, otherwise the Kalkageri will get in and spoil all the things in the house with their dirty tricks. The priests only have the power of driving them away by blessing the houses as they do on Christmas Day. And then, when Epiphany comes, these creatures are forced to flee underground, taking, before they go, a hack at the tree which supports the world, and which one day they will cut through. They are personified as being of evil shapes, huge men with goats' or asses' feet and wooden shoes, and when they stand erect their heads are higher than the highest chimney. In short, they are the modern representative of the satyrs. Next day, in spite of the mist and rain in which Komiaki was enshrouded, we set off to visit the unfinished colossal statue of Apollo, which lies near the sea at the foot of the mountain. Soon after leaving the village, we emerged from the mist and had a glorious day. The path led through a fertile valley, where some of the finest orange trees in Naxos grow on a property belonging chiefly to our host, the D-mark. Down by the sea is the marble hill of Naxos, which was worked as a quarry by the ancients, and close to which are numerous traces of antiquity. Steps down to the sea, Ionic columns, etc. On one side of the hill is cut in old letters, Oros Horiou Apollonos. Hence the hill is still known as Apollo's Hill, and the unfinished statue as one of Apollo. It lies at full length in the quarry out of which it has been hewn. From the sole of the feet to the crown of the head, it is 34 feet long. Across the chest, it is 68 inches, and 80 inches is the length of the arm from shoulder to elbow. It has evidently been intended for an erect, naked statue. The left foot is a little advanced. The arms from the shoulder to the elbow rest on the side, and are then stretched across the breast, which is very prominent. Locks of hair hang over the forehead, and at the chin a piece of marble has been left as if for a beard. It is all unfinished, but quite sufficiently advanced for one to be able to trace every limb, and very huge it looks as it lies on its back in the quarry, surrounded by mastic and shrubs. It is, of course, mere speculation to argue about its intended destination. Was it intended to replace the Naxiot statue of Apollo at Delos, which had been destroyed? Was it never finished because the marble was found to be imperfect? For it's obvious that the piece was not a good one, though it may have deteriorated with time and exposure. Or was it unfinished because some war or pestilence came to put an end to their work? Curiously enough, in Naxos I saw several unfinished statues. I was shown one of a woman in Potamia, and another has been found lately at Melanes. Ross says he also saw one, so it seems as if there had been a cause for this, which now we cannot tell. After a warm and pleasant day spent down by the shore, we returned to our mist and our damp at Komiaki.